today is number 094075, Joseph Michael O'Callaghan against Daniel Donahue as trustee in the matter of the bankruptcy of Mr. and Mrs. Solis. And Mr. O'Callaghan, you're arguing this yourself? Have a lot of paper to shuffle here.
Judge Hamilton, Judge Mannion, I'm Joseph O'Callaghan, pro se. With me this morning is my assistant, Suzanne Tinney, who is very helpful in the brief, but I do want to say that any errors in the brief are mine, not my staff's. May it please the court, we are here this morning because of a ruling by the district court that the attorney was not entitled to fees on the sum of $62,410 of stolen commingled funds because he had not recovered that money for his client by way of settlement. I'd first like to point out that the district court totally ignored the fact that there was a judgment in the case in the circuit court, and that is a crucial element, and I will return to that. But let me point out the position of the client at the beginning of the case. At the beginning of the case, at the beginning of the representation, Mr. Solis was in the possession of $62,410 of money which he knew was stolen. He did not have a penny of the $107,000 that was owed to him as his portion of the workman's compensation proceeds.
When did he learn that the, according to you, that the $62,000 came from stolen funds?
Your Honor, that's not a record. The only thing that he says is in his affidavit that he says he was aware that the money was stolen.
Who drafted that affidavit?
I did.
So he doesn't know, or you don't like the answer as to when he learned?
No, I simply don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
He had the money about a year or so?
I believe yeah. that's correct,
and
Your Honor.
And he got in touch with you because he hadn't gotten the rest of it?
That's correct. At the conclusion of the representation, Mr. Solis was in possession of a judgment that awarded him that disputed $62,410.
Is your position, Mr. O'Callaghan, that getting a judgment for a client amounts to a recovery?
Under these circumstances, yes, Your Honor.
Well, let's suppose some different circumstances. Suppose you get a judgment for him for $1 million from somebody who immediately then declares bankruptcy. Is that a recovery that would entitle you to 40% of the $1 million that the plaintiff never got?
It would entitle me to 40% of the funds. If the funds were uncollectible, they would be uncollectible.
They have to be collected, recovered, before the judgment would justify a fee award, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is this case different?
Because the funds were recovered. He didn't own the funds at the beginning of the case. He owned the funds.
Did anybody ever assert a claim for them?
Yes, Your Honor. Both the attorneys and the banks asserted claims for those funds. In addition to which, and here was the greater problem, why a judgment was necessary. Otherwise, it could have been handled by settlement if those were the only parties to the case. But the defalcations by Ms. Mora exceeded $1.5 million. So there were other claimants to these funds. We had to.
The thing that I guess that I'm troubled by here, Mr. O'Callaghan, is that You actually got $60,000 for him in cash that he didn't have before, right?
That's correct.
As I looked at your contingent fee agreement, there wasn't anything in there about a separate fee for defending him for claims that might have been made against him.
There was nothing that specified defense of the $62,000.
Isn't that really your theory, though, that you defended him from these potential claimants for that money that he already had?
No, Your Honor. It's our theory that the funds were recovered by means of the judgment that excluded claims by any other individuals.
How is that different from just winning a, in essence, what we would ordinarily call a defense judgment?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, let's put aside the $60,000 in cash that you actually recovered for him, okay? Suppose we look at the half of the case in which you are, in essence, defending him against these prospective potential claims that might be made by others to the funds that Ms. Mora had stolen and then divvied out some. You'd be acting as a defense lawyer, right?
No, Your Honor. We're asserting a claim to funds which are not his.
We're not connecting. He's got them. He's got the money, right?
He has the money in his possession. That doesn't make it his.
And the law won't, and unless there's a court that comes in and says, Mr. Solis, this isn't your money. You needed to give it to somebody else. It stays with him, right?
That would be correct.
Okay. So, in essence, with respect to that part of the case, you are defending him against potential claims, right?
I think we have a semantic difference, but I will concede.
And you can call it semantic if you want, but I'm trying to understand how it's recovery subject to a contingent fee to win a defense judgment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a recovery because at the beginning of the representation, he didn't own the money. At the conclusion of the representation.
That was the issue. Now, does Illinois allow contingent fees in defense cases, defending civil cases?
As far as I know, yes, Your Honor. There's certainly
you
no
direct
case.
Us to some case law about that?
I can't direct the court to any case law. I can direct the court to case law that is... well, yes, I can. I think even the In re Doyle case, which the trustee has cited in his brief, stands for the proposition that the attorney is entitled to a fee for that which the work that he does that is a benefit to his client. And I think that there...
What were the circumstances in Doyle?
My recollection is that there was a death. A client came to Attorney Doyle. There was an issue with regard to some insurance policies.
And the lawyer recovered
the lawyer
the insurance funds, right?
Yes.
So we've got money that goes from someplace else into the client's pocket, right?
That's correct.
It's pretty easy to understand how that would be a recovery.
Did the $60,000, that was probably from some insurance company, right?
The $60,000 primarily came from the bank defendants, Your Honor.
Well, the bank itself? I'm just looking at it. He got $60,000. Obviously, it's not, that's money that he is owed. The money was basically stolen, and so someone else paid it.
The banks paid it because of the forged endorsements on the on the checks.
And the 62, whatever it is, that came from their trust fund, the attorney's trust account?
No, Your Honor, that came from money that Mora had stolen.
Well, yeah, but she stole it from their trust account, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
came,
that's
right.
What I'm saying. So there's a lot of money that she took in addition to this, and she gave him half of what, more or less, what he had coming out of her own account that she'd stolen funds from, I guess.
Yes.
And I guess if you defended that or whatever you want to call it, I assume there were a lot of, there wasn't any money. There were a lot of other claims. Did the bank come up with the other claims too?
Our case dealt only with Mr. Solis's case.
I know, there were companion cases. I'm just looking at the same. The reason he was able to keep the 62, somebody else must have paid all the other people who got their money stolen. I don't know.
I know that some of them were
paid.
What
did you do to keep the 62? Maybe that's an easier question. You said you did something, I think.
We instituted the lawsuit. We joined the unknown defendants. We got a judgment against them. We got the...
Against unknown defendants?
Against unknown defendants. Yes, Your Honor. That's crucial.
Who actually asserted claims for Solis's $62,000?
There was at least one other lawsuit pending at the time asserting claims to the money that...
Against him?
Not against him individually, no.
So who... What claims, then, did you protect him against?
Against the claims of the unknown owners, the banks, because the banks asserted a claim to the money because it was the stolen money.
They thought he should pay it back.
That was their position.
Where did they assert that position?
In the litigation.
In the state court case?
The state court, as did the attorneys.
The attorneys thought they should get the money from Solis? After they'd represented him and their employee had stolen his money?
They asserted a claim to the funds because they were stolen.
Do we know what Mr. Solis's attitude towards the legal profession is at this point?
I haven't asked him, Your Honor.
Well, he filed bankruptcy, right?
He did. So that's why we're here.
Didn't have anything left. I assume whatever this money went to bankruptcy is at bankruptcy state. I guess somebody else paid the other people who had their money stolen, I think. I'm just guessing, but...
Some of them were paid. Some of them, I believe, were not paid.
Well, he got paid $60,000, and I think everybody else, the banks may have had to pony up for everybody. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but the question is this. Whose money did he get to keep?
He got to keep $62,410 of stolen commingled funds.
Why did he get to keep it? It's somebody else's money that was stolen.
Because the court awarded him a judgment entitling to keep the funds.
It had been stolen from him.
It could in part have been stolen from him.
Mr. O'Callaghan, if we separate out the part of the case in which you were defending Mr. Solis from these claims from unknown owners and others, how much time did you put into that part of the case?
Just the claims against the unknown owners?
Let's start with that.
I would, it's only a guess, Your Honor, but I would say 30 to 40 hours. We had to amend the complaint. We had to add them as defendants. We had to publish notice.
It took 30 to 40 hours of your time? But in any event, you took those steps in order to get a default judgment against unknown claimants.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And against the banks. The judgment also related to the banks. The attorneys waived any claim to the fees.
That was probably wise, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it was probably wise, yes. Your Honor, I would like to call the court's attention to the terms of the Illinois Attorney's Lien Act that provides that an attorney is entitled to a reasonable fee for services rendered. And the case of Rhodes versus Norfolk and Western Railroad, in which the Illinois Supreme Court said if the attorney has performed all of his services at the time of his discharge, and he's a contingent fee attorney, he is entitled to the contingent fee. And although the court, I believe, is troubled by the language of whether this is recovered or not, the court should not ignore the fact that work was done and resulted in a benefit to Mr. Solis that he did not have prior to the commencement of the litigation.
If he's a contingent fee attorney, he's entitled to the fee. Is that the law?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What you read, he said if he's a contingent fee attorney, he's entitled to his fee. Is that what you just read in the law?
Yeah, the Illinois Supreme Court in Rhodes versus Norfolk and Western says if you have a contingent fee attorney, you discharge him, which is your right, essentially at the point where he has recovered, somebody else comes in and gets the judgment of settlement, the contingent fee attorney discharges.
But he has a contingent fee agreement, though. That's what we're looking at. In order to get it, he has a contingent fee agreement.
Right.
That's sort of the opposite of what happened here, right? I mean, everybody knows it's not fair to, in essence, win your case and somebody else swoops in and grabs the fee at the very last second when the client fires you and tries to avoid paying the fee.
That's precisely what the trustee's trying to do, Your Honor. The trustee's trying to come in and say, this is my money.
Okay. Do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
If I may, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Then, Mr. Orduno? Orduno? Or the trustee?
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I am Jeff Orduno, and I do represent Dane O'Donoghue, the bankruptcy trustee. To pick up right where Your Honor left off, I would suggest that it is the kind of contorted logic that Mr. O'Callaghan is putting forth that it makes people think lowly of lawyers. And what we have here is him trying to collect all this money out of this $60,000 pool of money. To follow up on some of the questions that the Court had out there that I'm not sure were adequately answered, it seems from the best evidence in the record that Mr. Solis did not know the funds were stolen at the time he took the cashier's check. Where I draw that from is at document 1-9 at page 34, specifically paragraph 37. In the document I'm pointing to there, first of all, that is an exhibit to the trustee's 7056 statement. That's a nice collection of all the documents in the case. It appears elsewhere because it was Mr. O'Callaghan that introduced the document, but that's where I'm citing it from. If we look at paragraph 37 there, it tells us that in April 2005, Mr. Solis was communicated to, or maybe he was communicating with, his attorney's office, and that's the point at which he was advised that the funds that he had received from Mora Mora were stolen. The last thing we know before that is that in February 2005, he gets this cashier's check from her, and then there are a couple of paragraphs in this pleading, because this is the complaint in the state law case. There are a couple of paragraphs that tell us he continues to try and call to find out what's going on with the money because he needs the rest of his money, and then ultimately we see this reference to in April 2005, he hears from the attorneys that there was this grand scheme of theft. So it sounded from the pleading as if there would be some workout at that time, like they said, but don't worry, we'll get you your money for reasons probably obvious to all of us. But evidently that wasn't forthcoming. That complaint was signed by Mr. O'Callaghan. So to me, that's the best evidence in the record on what Mr. Solis knew when. There is no evidence in the record that he knew at the time he took that check that those funds were stolen, that had given rise to the cashier's check. Frankly, Your Honors, I treat the cashier's check as cash, as does the Illinois court systems. If he had no other knowledge of any defense or alteration or issue with that check, there is no evidence that he wasn't taking good faith, and he did take it for value in his mind. He took it for value in two ways, Your Honors. First of all, he thought that this was part of his payment for the settlement of his case. Secondly, even to the extent that Mr. O'Callaghan says, well, he should have thought it was fishy that he didn't get all the money, I would tell you this. One thing that he was told by Ms. Mora was that the balance of the proceeds were going to be used to pay off a loan. Apparently, and this also comes from that same state court complaint, apparently some months prior, a handful of months prior, Mr. Solis is communicating with his attorney's office and seemingly speaking with Ms. Mora, saying, I really need that money. I know that settlement is done. I really need that money. I'm trying to buy a house. Whereupon she arranges for some type of quick loan at 56 or 57% interest. That comes directly out of the complaint, Your Honors. Some 57% interest.
You say a loan to her?
A loan by a third-party lender to Mr. Solis against these future funds.
Arranged by Mora.
Arranged by Mora. So then he shows up. He gets, I believe, $60,000 at that point. So then She, at some point in February or maybe the end of January, that's not clear in my recollection, judges, but it's simply reading through this complaint, she at some point communicates with him and says, okay, you can probably, and further prompting by him, you can come get your 62-410, and the rest of it will be used to pay off that loan. So he shows up to get his 62-410, gets a cashier's check. He thinks things are done. This is less clear from the complaint, but I'm guessing what he's calling Mora Mora about, or his attorney's office about, as we go through this future couple of months between then and April 2005, when he learns of the scheme, I'm guessing he's calling saying, look, I'm getting hounded by this lender. I need this money.
Let's not guess.
Okay, and that's fair, Judge. That's fair. But that is the best construction of that document.
Is there any money in this trustee of the state?
Your Honor,
this looks like everybody's going after what isn't there.
Your Honor, that may be fair. I believe there is some, but not enough to cover this spread, number one. Number two, I would take that opportunity to point out, Judge Manning, that the 62-410 never came into the bankruptcy estate. That may have been obvious to the court, but I would point that out. So it's
gone.
Presumably, Judge. And again, I won't guess, but yeah, I think so. Your Honor, I would point out that I don't believe that the record contains any reference to a claim or any solid evidence of a claim by these banks. Okay, we see Mr. O'Callaghan filing the state court suit, and we see claims in there about the things and the theft scheme and conversion, and the bank shouldn't have let the check go through that way. We see those things. I don't recall, and I've looked at the entire record within the last day or so, I don't recall seeing any kind of like a counterclaim by one of these banks. I would point that out. If Mr. O'Callaghan corrects me, Your Honor, I do apologize, but I don't recall seeing one. Number two, I would suggest that one of the natural effects of what's happened here is Mr. O'Callaghan's actions may have, let's say, invited claims. To the extent that, again, we don't know this, but I would just say we're looking at these pools of money. They're $60,000 and they're $62,410, the old money. It would seem shocking that there would not be some discussion about, hey, by the way, to get that other 60, you're going to have to give me 49 of that. And if we lose, by the way, we might be prompting some other claim to pop out of the woodwork. This is contrary to any reasonableness, and I'll tie that back later, Judge, to a case, Segovia, in terms of is it reasonable what we charge for fees when we talk about the scope of the case. But I did just want to address that because it seemed tethered to what the court was talking about. Finally, one of the other points the court raised was there evidence of or how much time was spent? I would suggest that despite multiple, I'll euphemize them as invitations, to put that kind of evidence into the record, I believe Mr. O'Callaghan has failed to put any time evidence into the record. And when I say this, Judge,
he was invited to do so?
Yeah, Judge, and when I say that, I would suggest that there was a very early petition for attorney's fees that he filed, whereupon we respond and say, no, this isn't right. And we actually break down under the Illinois rules in cases like SAS and say, wait a minute, no, you've got to show that this fee is reasonable, et cetera, et cetera. He doesn't take that opportunity, to my recollection. Then there's a turnover where the trustee actually squeezes the money out of these other parties and actually brings the $60,000 into the estate. Okay. And at that point, there's further back and forth. And then finally, we file a motion for summary judgment with a 7056 statement. And Mr. O'Callaghan files a cross motion for summary judgment with a 7056 statement. I don't believe there's a billing record attached anywhere to any of that on his part. And I would suggest that might have been a reasonable response, but it is now too late. Your Honor, now I'll kind of just jump into my main argument, and I think the court is keyed in that under 502b1, claims that are unenforceable can't stand. If they're, if we have a way to point to them being unenforceable, what we did was say, look at the fee contract. It calls for 40% of any gross amount recovered, as the court suggests by its questions, and as the courts below both found and held, there was no recovery of those funds here. We contend that those courts were right, and we would ask you to do the same. Specifically, Judge Reinhart phrased it basically the plain meaning of the contract as recover is to get something back that's not currently in one's possession. I would suggest that's reasonable. I don't see a reason to construe recover otherwise. I don't believe there is an Illinois case that construes it otherwise. I point to the Doyle case, and Mr. O'Callaghan also does. We both seem to think it works for us. I would point out that contingent fee cases envision a recovery, specifically. Here's the language of Doyle. I know we don't prefer quotes here, but if we were to follow the attorney's theory, any speculation would be
better than a paraphrase.
Perhaps, Judge. If we were to follow the attorney's theory, any speculation of a future challenge to a legal matter, regardless of how well-grounded in fact, would allow members of the bar to take most cases on a contingent fee basis. The point of that in Doyle, and that's at page 467 of 144 Illinois 2nd, the point of that in Doyle, my reading of it, is that Illinois doesn't generally allow contingent fee cases in all subject areas, or in all subject areas wouldn't be quite right, but in all postures, let's say, to go to Your Honor's earlier point, Judge Hamilton, that weren't you really defending the money? That's right. There is no crystal clear case. I was shocked to find from the day this case first came into my office until now that there is no crystal clear case that says you cannot have a contingent fee for defending money. But we know that to have a contingent fee, the case is required that there be a recovery. We have that language that tells us, wait a minute, you know, we don't just generally allow cases on contingent fees. And then finally, we have Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5 tells us, it basically lays out the framework and envisions money coming into the hands of the attorney. It envisions proceeds that are coming in, and then basically an accounting of those proceeds. It's kind of like you have to account for that and then send the rest on to your client. Dear client, I've taken out my 33 1/3% fee pursuant to the agreement. Here's the and kill costs. Here's the rest. That's what Rule 1.5 seems to envision. Rule 1.5, I will concede, does not expressly say you can't have a contingent fee for defending things.
Well, if a client comes to me and says I've been sued by somebody who wants $10 million, and that's the prayer for relief in the complaint, in Illinois, would I be allowed as an attorney to enter into a contract that says you'll pay me 40% of any amount less than $10 million that you wind up paying this fellow?
I believe that answer is no, Your Honor, but I believe that also requires a subtle reading or a thoughtful reading of Doyle and Rule 1.5.
And some recognition of how law actually gets practiced.
That's right, Judge. I mean, that's right.
The question just doesn't come up, does it?
It hasn't, I believe, Judge. And I think this particularly odd in this case is the kind of split nature of the case, that we have kind of an old pool of money and a new pool of money, and Attorney O'Callaghan acting to defend, we would say, the old pool, and meanwhile get the new pool, and
the pool is empty.
Your Honor, it's depleting as I speak, I hate to report. Moving on from the a little bit, he raises this absolute advisable and necessary. He points throughout his brief to some admission that the trustee in the 7056 statement admitted that extinguishing the claims against the unknown owners was, quote, advisable and necessary. Your Honors, to give that context, that was when we said, okay, yeah, we admit that. I mean, we admitted in the same sense that I would tell a colleague if he came to me and said, hey, I'm about to settle up this case that we're defending, and we're going to pay the money out to the other side, and the case is going to get dismissed with prejudice. Is there anything else I need to do? I would say, well, I probably wouldn't say it would be advisable and necessary. I'd probably say, you probably had better get a release and settlement, some settlement document, a release of all claims, as long as everybody's at the table and if that's proper. I would say that's advisable and necessary, number one, in the client's interest, and number two, so that when some claim might rear its head later, we haven't malpracticed. That's what we meant by advisable and necessary, at least in responding to Mr. O'Callaghan's suggestion that it was advisable and necessary to extinguish the claims of unknown owners, none of which ever actually surfaced.
Mr. Arduino, can I ask you a question here? But the one of the things that's kind of curious here is that Mr. O'Callaghan is pointing out that $122,410 is more than Mr. Solis's after-fee share of the original settlement. Can you account for that difference?
Your Honor, Mr. O'Callaghan points it out at different points in his brief by footnote, I believe two different footnotes. There's some $14,000 difference. I believe that what he was paid was the entire amount that he would have had coming without the discount of attorney's fees for his initial attorneys. I believe is where that $14,000 is, that's some part of it. He otherwise was entitled to $107,000. And Mr. O'Callaghan got him, in effect, in his mind, $122,000, defending $62,000, getting another $60,000. Your Honor, briefly on this Holder in due course issue.
I don't understand that answer.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge.
Where did the extra $14,000 come from? Solis wound up with a total of $122,000 in his pockets, at least temporarily, but for the bankruptcy.
$62,410, correct, Judge. And then another $60,000 came in. Mr. O'Callaghan is basically saying that he got that out of the other parties.
No, but why was that total more than Solis was owed by his attorneys from the original workers' comp settlement?
Mr. O'Callaghan would suggest, and I don't specifically deny this, that his work got him a higher amount settlement. He got him extra money in that settlement amount.
Okay.
Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Not really, but if there's no answer, there's no answer. So
before you indicated that it may be something like statutory fees out of the workers' comp. I misunderstood you.
I'm sorry.
You said something about other attorneys.
Marte and Bailey's, I believe one or both of their fees, after being reduced, there would have been $107,000 left for Mr. Solis. Yeah. So Mr. O'Callaghan is pointing out when he says he got more, he's saying that I actually got them $120,000. I got them $122,000. He got the money out of other places.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Orduno.
I see my time has elapsed. Thank you, Judge.
O'Callaghan, rebuttal? I think you've got about a minute and a half left.
Your Honor, to answer the last question, the additional funds were with respect to claims that we made for interest and for disallowance of the attorney's fees in the workers' comp proceeding.
Could you answer a couple of the questions that Mr. Orduno raised? One, whether there are any billing records in the record here?
There are no billing records, Your Honor. This is a contingent fee case. Contingent fee lawyers don't keep hourly records. We are not.
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And is there any place where counterclaims were asserted against Mr. Solis?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Where do we find those?
I don't think they are in the record. It would be in the circuit court. And not all of the circuit court pleadings are included in the record in this case.
Isn't that sort of essential to your claim?
Well, Your Honor, there's the release from the banks and the attorneys. That certainly covers their claims. They release those claims specifically in the release, and that's quoted at pages 11 and 12 of the brief. In addition to which, the judgment itself recites that the attorney defendants waive their claims, and the banks default on Solis's claim. With regard to the issue of hourly fees, this is not an hourly fee case, Your Honor. There is no requirement that a contingent fee attorney keep hourly records. There's simply no need to do that. So there are no hourly fee records. Hourly records in the case. In addition to which, I believe we heard a lot of speculation from Mr. Orduno about what was going on below based upon the complaint, and I think that that's really not facts of record.
We'll try to stick to the record as we address this. Your time has expired. Do you have any last thoughts you'd like to wrap up?
Yes, as to the holder in due course issue, Your Honor, which Mr. Orduno raised, that was waived. Nobody raised that below.
All right. Thank you, Mr. O'Callaghan. The case is taken under advisement. We'll move on to the third case of the day.